Writing nonfiction, which is what I did for a living for a long, long time, while I wrote fiction at night, writing nonfiction, writing for magazines, writing some really bad stuff was always my day job. I taught for a while, and then I thought, oh, this is just way too much work. And writing nonfiction was fun. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed getting out of myself, out of my own head. But it made me such a workhorse so that an editor from a magazine could call and say, you know, we need this tomorrow at 8 a.m. And I would say, no problem. And that actually did trickle down into my fiction. I'm not a precious person at all. And I'm very good at just getting the job done and getting down to work. And if I write something that I think is really, really beautiful, some of the best writing I've ever done, but it doesn't really fit in, I don't leave it in the novel, I take it out. And that comes from nonfiction.
One thing that I saw you learned, especially working at 17 Magazine, is how not to take criticism personally, which I think, yes, in whatever art you do is a really important lesson that's very difficult to actually acquire.
Yes. And even if it isn't art, if it's just regular life, I mean, as long as it's not personal criticism, that would be something else. But I think that a lot of times people are telling us what we need to do our job better, what they expect from us, what their expectations are. And you should just get that done without having to run into the ladies' room and sob for 10 minutes every single time.
Well, and that's the thing, right? We all want it to be better in the end. So as long as we can kind of understand that goal, you know.
Do we all want it to be better in the end, or do we all just want buckets of unconditional love? I know it was a really hard thing for me as a teacher when I wrote nonfiction and I taught. And I always thought I was being nice. I'm basically a pretty nice person, and I'm very straightforward. And so if a student gave me a story or a piece of work that I thought had problems, I would say, well, you know, this is what's good, and these are the problems, and these are the things that you need to work on. And then they would burst into tears and run out of the room. And and I think that actually a lot of people don't want constructive criticism. People just want you to say, this is the best thing I've ever read in my life. I can quit right now and feel totally fulfilled.
That's funny.
What people want.
One thing I really loved that you wrote about magazine writing was that it gave you a skill that you found essential for fiction, which was the ability to fake authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a friend who was a caterer, and she told me once that no matter what you make or how badly you screw it up, you just put your shoulders back, stand up straight, put your chin up, and you say, this is the way it is. You know, the rumaki is burned. What, you've never had burnt rumaki? Oh, I'm sorry. That's the way they do it in Japan. If you carry yourself as if you're supposed to be there, the world will welcome you. You can walk into any wedding and eat their food and drink their wine and dance to their band if you look like you belong. And I think that the same thing is true in writing. You have to have authority, even if you're faking it. You have to be a voice that says, I'm the one who's going to lead you through this story. You're going to follow me. You're going to believe me. And so much of that is just about attitude. Yes, it's about skill and knowing what you're doing and having your facts straight. But part of it is just developing the authority to lead the reader through.
Absolutely. That is interesting. So were there certain pieces that you ended up including in This is the Story of a Happy Marriage that were hard for you to go back and read?
Oh, yeah. Well, everything was. That's my biggest problem as a writer, that I have no ability to go back and read my own work. I have never read any of my novels. Again, when you finish a book, you read it like 20 times because all of the different levels of editing and copy editing, proofreading and final page pass, and you read it so much. And I break with my work emotionally. When I write a piece for a magazine, I read it over and over and over again. And just in a row, I'll read it 5-10 times in a row. I'll read it out loud. And so by the time it's published, I could no more make myself read it than I could fly to the moon. So for me to go back and read these essays was almost impossible. And actually, a friend of mine put the book together for me because she really wanted me to do this book, and I kept saying, no, no, no. She went through the essays, she picked out the first batch and put a book together. It took me months before I could read it. And then I didn't like two-thirds of what was in it and threw it out. And I was really good about writing the new pieces, but going back and rereading the old pieces, and especially reading them so many times, was really hard.
Hmm. So do you read everything out loud before it gets published?
I do. And it's torture. It's just awful. But it makes an enormous difference because they're just repetitions. You know, you use the same word and you don't realize you've done it until you hear it out loud. With my novels, for the past few novels, my friend Jane Hamilton has let me read the books to her. And that really makes a huge difference.
I bet.
As opposed to me reading them to my dog, where I'm just boring myself to death. But Jane will lie there on the couch with her eyes closed, and then every now and then she'll raise her hand and she'll say, nope, you said banana 10 pages ago or whatever. And it's great.
That is really wonderful.
And this book, I did the audio recording, and that's really funny because, of course, by then there's nothing you can do about it. If you find a mistake, it's
Ooh.
Just too late. You have to keep going.
Wow, that would be potentially excruciating.
So you have to really read it a lot early on.
So one thing you talk about is the idea that someone can read all of your novels but still not have a sense of who you are personally.
Right.
And it's true that this book is really, really intimate. I mean, it's a very private look at yourself and your life. Do you think differently about kind of critical reception because it's such a more of a piece of you than your novels?
I do think differently about the critical reception, and I have no clue what the critical reception is going to be, or if it's going to be, if it'll even happen. With a novel, if I get a bad review, it's a bad review about a piece of art that I made, and that can be hurtful or upsetting for a very, very short period of time. If somebody doesn't like this book, then I kind of think it doesn't matter. It's not going to matter to me because it's about my life. And if someone doesn't like something that I did in my life, it's really not going to matter to me. And as far as the writing is concerned, at this point in the game, I know how to write. I mean, I don't think that somebody's going to come out and say, oh, the writing was just a mess. I've been doing this for a long time, and that's settled. It's going to be more a matter of the critical response to the content, and the content is just what happened. So I think that's going to be fine.
That's really interesting. I would have guessed you would have said the other way around.
Yeah. No, who knows? Let's talk again in a month after the reviews have come out. But I don't think it's going to be a problem. Although I have to say, at this point in my life, reviews in general aren't a problem. I'm kind of over all of that. A good review makes me really happy for 10 minutes, and a bad review makes me sad for 10 minutes, and I've kind of gotten it down to that level.
That's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So another theme that I really admire, because I feel like we don't talk about it enough, is how you put it is the elegance of quitting at the right time.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
You know,
I'm working on that skill.
It's a really difficult skill. And I think so often in this day and age, we're pressured into saying yes to as many things as we can. And there's a lot to celebrate about that idea. But I think there's a lot also of saying, wait a second, this isn't good for me. I need to stop this.
Yes. And that's something that I feel in my life right now. I was actually talking to my husband about that very thing this weekend. So much of my life changed when I opened the bookstore, and I went from having a life that I really guarded and I was very private about, and I was always trying to protect my time, to a life that is very, very public, I'm doing all sorts of things in the community now. I'm the spokesperson for independent bookstores all right. over the country, so I'm called on to do all of these things. And like this week alone, this week, we have Garrison Keillor and Pat Conroy and Elizabeth Gilbert coming in to do readings. So I'm going to be at those three readings. I'm interviewing Pat Conroy on stage. Liz Gilbert's one of my best friends. It's just a completely different life. I never would have written this book had it not been for the fact that now my life is so public and open, and I'm really a part of the community. But because I write books, people are always asking me to do things. And some of those things make really great sense. You know, I'm on the board for the library. Okay, that makes sense. The Literacy Coalition just asked me to host their fundraiser. Okay, that makes sense. I'll do that. But then there are all sorts of other things like, you know, will you go on this bank board? will you come and be part of a school project? And I really have to stop and think, gosh, if I do all of these things, then I will no longer be able to do the thing that creates the reason why you want me to do these other things, right?
Yeah.
So if I participate in all of these things, then I no longer will be a novelist. And the reason you want me to participate in all of these things is because I am a novelist. So all my life, I've been really good at protecting myself and having boundaries. Now, the bookstore has completely blown all my boundaries away. I've had a fantastic time. I am having a fantastic time doing that and learning a lot about myself and about my community. But now I'm going to have to go back and try to figure out what the balance is.
I bet that would be really difficult. So are you a bookstore owner before you're a writer these days?
No, I'm not. I'm definitely a writer. But kind of more than anything, I'm the impresario. It's not like I'm running the cash register. I am not ordering the books. I am not hiring people. But I am, I always say I'm the benevolent overlord.
Oh, nice. You know,
I'm sort of the face of the project. And there are a lot of things I need to show up for. And what I tell myself is this isn't asking too much. Considering the good that it does, the reward that I get from participating in my community, both my community of Nashville, but the community of writers, the community of booksellers, publishers, these are all really good things. And so I need to just enjoy them and appreciate them and realize that they are enriching my life and not depleting my life. And there's that old joke about if you want to get something done, ask a busy person. And I'm sort of becoming that busy person. And people can just ask me to do things. And a lot of times I can get it done really fast.
That is an important skill to have, for sure.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about what inspired you to open Parnassus?
Yeah, sure. The bookstores went away. It was very inspiring. We had two 30,000 square foot bookstores. One was a Borders, and of course the whole Borders chain shut, and one was Davis Kidd, which used to be our beloved locally owned and operated independent bookstore, but it had been bought by a chain out of Ohio, and they got too big, and they kind of imploded and had to close the stores. So these stores were both profitable. It wasn't Nashville's fault that we lost our stores, but they were both closed. I thought someone's going to open a bookstore. Lots of weeping and beating of breasts. We have to have a bookstore. Someone's got to do this. And nobody seemed to do it. And I met this woman named Karen Hayes. We were introduced by a mutual friend as the two people who really felt there needed to be a bookstore. And we formed a partnership over the course of one sandwich. And I said, well, I'll be the silent partner. I'll pay for it. And you do all the work and you run it. And I haven't turned out to be the silent partner. I, in fact, have turned out to be the partner who never shuts up because Karen's very shy. And she's the one who's in the back ordering all the books and doing all the work. And I'm the person who's always standing up on a bench saying what the importance of independent bookselling is in our community and what we value. So that's my job.
So I actually didn't know the meaning of the word Parnassus before.
Me neither.
Really?
Me
so
neither.
Was it Karen's choice then?
Yeah, totally. 100% Karen's choice.
It's so good.
And I said, oh, no, nobody's going to know what it means. And it's going to make people feel stupid and they're not going to know how to spell it. And I think we need something much more direct. And she looked at me. This was the first day we met. She looked at me and she said, I always wanted a bookstore called Parnassus. And I thought, well, you know what? This isn't a compromise issue. You know, either you get your way or I get my way. And you're the one who's going to go to work there every day. And so you should get to name the store.
It's
and
such a good name.
That was it. Thank you. I'll tell Karen.
Good. Please do. Will you tell our listeners what Parnassus means?
Parnassus is the mountain in Greece where poetry, dance, and music were born, the muses, the gods of all things important and artistic came from Mount Parnassus.
So a lot of this book involves your relationship with writing and words, but it also has to do with your relationships with men in your life.
Yeah, and women and dogs.
And women and dogs. And your parents.
Yeah.
And their past, the way you put it, as failures of marriage.
Yes.
And that would be, you say, four generations of your family, right? Failed at marriage in one way or another.
Yes. And I think just about everybody in my generation. I figured out I have one cousin on my father's side. He was one of seven. Six of those children got married. They all had a lot of children. And of all of the Patchett cousins, there's only one of us who is still in their marriage of origin.
Wow.
Yeah, we're just bums on the marriage front.
Well, I think it is really enlightening that what you point out in the story, The Sacrament of Divorce, that idea that there weren't more happy marriages before divorce was socially acceptable. There were just a lot of really miserable people.
I think so.
It makes sense.
I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, if you think about being forced to stay in an unhappy marriage, I don't think you think, wow, I bet if we'd hung in there for another 5 years, we would have worked it out. Divorce always breaks my heart. Always feel when I hear that someone's getting divorced, it's the same little thing that I feel when you hear somebody has cancer. You just think, oh, I wish this hadn't happened. I'm so, so sorry this happened. And that said, of course, I got divorced when I was 25, and I look back on that as one of the greatest gifts of my life. If I had had to have spent my whole life in that marriage, I really don't think it would have worked out. And I think that the good things that came in my life came because I was married to somebody else or because I was single.